Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters at Home. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
And I'm Tamsy Thompson.
For our seventh episode of Architecture Masters at Home, we're joined by the artist and designer Yinka Olori, described by the Financial Times as one of the world's most in-demand designers. Born in London, much of his work references his West African heritage. Yinka established his studio in 2017 with a loan from the Prince's Trust, producing upcycled furniture that were as much furniture as works of art. In 2018, he won the LFA's competition with Wandsworth Council to improve a gloomy underpass of the Thessaly Road railway bridge in Battersea. The competition called for designs to improve the experience for pedestrians and cyclists. His winning concept, Happy Streets, was designed and delivered for the 2019 festival and vastly improved the experience of the underpass with a riot of colour. Together with architects Price Gore, Yinka also won the 2019 competition for the LFA's second Dulwich Pavilion. Their winning entry, the Colour Palace, proved a huge success, attracting nearly 100,000 visitors to the South London Gallery. The pavilion's lattice structure and geometric patterns were described as mesmerising by The Guardian. Yinka is now in huge demand from companies around the world, from fashion brands to television stations. With his studio space now closed, we joined Yinka down the line from his London home, where we started by asking, given everything he does, whether he was still happy with the artist-designer label.
Yes, artist-designer, yeah, that is how I would describe myself, thank you.
And you normally work out of your studio, but I presume you're not able to go there now, so where are you speaking to us from?
Yeah, so I'm speaking to you from my home, and I've been working from home for the last, I think nearly, it's going to be about 4 weeks. Yeah, this week will be 4 weeks. It's been interesting, yeah, working from home. I think it was tough the first week, but I'm starting to get used to it now. Yeah, it's quite a luxury to work from home.
You don't normally work alone though, do you? You have a sort of team of people that you work with, so how are you managing that in the kind of current situation?
Yeah, I think... So there's a team, there's about four of us in the studio, and usually I only have Friday to myself in the studio, and on the other days it's a full house of everyone in the team working on a range of projects. So what we've been doing now is we've been working via Zoom, which has been, I thought would be quite tricky, but I'm starting to enjoy working like this. And I think there's always that kind of perception that, you know, you always have to kind of be in the studio and that's the most kind of most effective way and efficient way. But I think I'm having a bit of a kind of, you know, like a different kind of view on that. And I feel like when new things probably get back to normal, I think working from home might be an idea that I might kind of implement in the studio, maybe like one day a week or 2 days a week you can work from home, because we've been keeping ourselves busy. And sort of thinking of new ways of working, thinking of new ideas, and so yeah, it's been good. I'm sort of getting used to that way of working now. I'm enjoying it.
And it's not compromising the kind of creativity at all. You're able to kind of still spark off each other and follow.
Yeah, we are. I mean, initially, I sort of found it quite difficult, but what I'll be honest with you, because we were going through a time where we were extremely busy in the studio, and we were juggling quite a few projects, and I kind of felt like I wasn't sort of giving like each project the amount of time I would have wanted to have given it, but now we're working at a slower pace now on all projects that have been delayed or postponed. I'm kind of finding that I'm designing. very differently. How I'm thinking is very different. My sort of design process and thought process is a lot different now. And I think sort of things that I want to sort of say or I care about in design now is shifting as well. So I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely been.
And are you able to tell us any of the projects that you're working on at the moment? Are you able to tell us anything about them?
Can I? I can say we're working on a few kind of public or own projects. I don't know if I can say what they are, but I think off recording, I can tell you. Off mic, yes. It involves a lot more kind of placemaking projects, which I think will be, you know, very important, I think, in the next few months, for a lot of people who have been working at home and who have been also practicing social distancing. I'm really looking forward to kind of, you know, injecting some happiness and some, you know, work that will allow people to, you know, hopefully in the next few months, or maybe, I don't know, maybe next year, to be able to kind of interact with each other again, because that's the core of what I do. My work is very much about placemaking and bringing people together. So that's been quite hard, you know, sort of designing something at home, but then not being able to kind of see it realised this year. We're sort of, it allows me and allows the team to kind of develop the idea a lot more, to a point that it will, you know, hopefully play a positive and have a positive impact in people's lives and also in communities and spaces in London. So we're doing a lot more kind of public run projects.
Yeah, a lot of our audience will know your work from the Dulwich Pavilion, from Thessaly Road, but just be interested to get a bit of background, how you became a designer, what your route into design and art was. When did you, we talked to a lot of architects who talk about, you know, maybe their parents were architects, they knew they wanted to be an architect from the age of three or something. what was your
wow, routine? Bloody hell. Yeah, so I think my background, you know, I went to school, you know, an all-boys school in North London, and, you know, my parents, you know, always wanted us to be something that was a bit more, I don't know, whether it was a doctor or an engineer, something academic. That was what they wanted us to be. So I remember when I was like, I don't know, five or six, you know, sort of really young, I always loved to like playing with toys and cars and, I don't know, like just anything that I could play with, essentially. And I remember my parents would always buy me, you know, anything. It could be a car, or it could be a tractor anything that had a motor in it. And before, by the end of the day, that car or toy would be like in pieces, because I was always wanted to find out how that car worked, what was the mechanism in that toy or that object I had. So I always loved playing and making things. And I went on to go and, you know, study GCSE art, and then went on to go and do an A-level in fine art. So I think before I loved design, my first love, I think, in honest truth, was always fine art and art. So I wanted to be an artist when I was like 16, 17. But my worry was that, and I always will say this, at the time, I always felt you had to be dead to be successful, or you'd be a dead artist, and you work with go for millions. And I based it on like Picasso and like Francis Bacon and, you know, I don't know, like all the artists that we studied at, you know, I studied at school. And I didn't really want that for me. I was like, I want to be a living artist and making some serious money. So that was out the window. And then I went on to go and study a BTEC in art and design at City, London Metropolitan, I know, at City and Islington University, a college. And I studied sort of art design. I did product design, furniture, fashion for like the whole year. So I did everything in art design for a whole year. And then I discovered that I was actually quite good at product and furniture design. And then I went on to go and do a BA in furniture and product design. And then did my degree for 3 years. And then I interned for Lee Broom, who is a furniture or a product designer, British designer, who has a studio in Shoreditch. And I worked for Lee Broom for a few months, which was amazing, because I got to really get, I got an insight into kind of how to, you know, like start a business, and you know, like how to, you know, sort of like have an idea, but then bring the idea to life, working with manufacturers and upholsterers, everything of how to kind of, you know, start a project, which was really good for me, because when you're at uni, you do projects, but they're real, but not really real projects, so they don't really go anywhere, unless it's a live project with actually a real company. So that was good. But then what I kind of found is that when I was at Lee Broom, which was, again, a great opportunity, but I felt that the work I was kind of doing wasn't a true reflection of what I wanted to say and what I wanted my work to be about. And then I went on to go and I went to the Prince's Trust and I got a loan of like £3,000 to start my own business. And that's how I started the Yinko Laurie. Yeah, designing furniture.
And so furniture was the, what's interesting is I guess you started to make a name for yourself on furniture, but fairly quickly started doing some much bigger scale projects, I guess projects which kind of straddle the boundary between art and architecture. And obviously the Dulwich Pavilion was done with architects, Price Gore. Just be interesting to kind of get your thoughts on the difference maybe between art and architecture or design and architecture and working with architects. What, yeah, was that an easy process, difficult process? You know, what was the...
I think I always do say this, and I think I'm not ashamed to say it. I think when I, and I think, I don't know if I've ever told Tams this before actually, but I think when I pitched, you know, for the Happy Street project, for Test the Road project commission, I went into that project quite blind, because I sort of, you know, and also working with Price Gore, I sort of didn't imagine the amount of, I didn't, you know, sort of undervalued the amount of work and you know, and I don't know, and experience that you might, well, you need to have to do projects like this. So I sort of, you know, we had the render and I, you know, had the kind of sketches and the proposal and I was, oh, that's it now. You know, we've won the project. Oh, I can chill and relax now. But I remember on many occasions thinking to myself, why did I get involved in this project? I was like, you're an idiot. You're like, you're not even an architect. Why, like, this is a lot of work. I mean, I haven't got a clue about surveys and, you know, like, how to, all this kind of architectural lingo. And then there's so much stuff that was really stressful through this whole process. So I think there are, like, some differences in, like, I don't know, like, in things like the process was very different. I mean, and how like Price Gore worked and how I worked, it was a different kind of process. I think we think differently. For example, I don't know, this for me, like as a designer, I feel like I can kind of make anything because I'm very much used to kind of working on a smaller scale with products and again, sort of working on a sort of 2D scale. But when it's kind of a architectural kind of, you know, like building, it's a different process that I wasn't aware of, and it was, you know, a huge learning curve for me on so many levels. But in terms of like the feeling and kind of the emotion you want to kind of you want the kind of audience or the public to feel, I think it's very similar because the work that I do, I'm trying to, you know, like evoke a feeling and try and evoke an emotion, and also trying to sort of create a memory. In memory and kind of in something that you're going to experience and that you can kind of share with people. So as an artist, I think artists, you know, try to capture, you know, an essence or a feeling or a time. And I think architecture, I think does that. And I think the Colour Palace did that. And I think lots of buildings, you know, try to immerse you into their world. And so yeah, I think there are similarities in that in that way, but I think in terms of like the process and how like architects and artists work and designers, I think is very different because I think I don't know, I just always had this idea that you can kind of, as a I sort of thought as a designer you can kind of do anything and anything, but when you're having to kind of like work with engineers and work with quantity surveyors and work with I don't know, like different people, there's so many layers to it. And I think I didn't know that, you know. I'm sorry to the architectural world. I apologize. I didn't know that. But now I know.
It's really interesting. A lot of talk about certainly the Dulwich Pavilion was about emotion really and how it makes people feel. And I guess that's one thing your work's been known for is the kind of emotional response and how you change people's emotions, you know, the kind of real fixation on happiness. And I guess that's going to be increasingly important as we all start moving out of lockdown and talking a bit about public realm spaces. it seems like you're slightly moving up the scale of size of projects. If you're looking at kind of public realm, you've worked with some brands, of you've done some store designs. Are you still thinking about bigger scale? I mean, just talk us through scale.
I really enjoyed, you know, like the Colour Palace and doing the Dusty Roads bridge project, but I mean, the reward was amazing, but I think it's just you need a lot of experience. Yeah, you need a good team of people around you who, you know, and you know, prior school were incredible because, you know, they're architects, they're fully qualified architects, and you know, in our studio we don't have fully qualified architects. We have part ones and part twos. So I don't know if it's something I'd want to. I love the idea of it. And I think if I've got the right team, you know, and you know, people who've got the right experience, then yeah, but. I don't know. I think I'd love to do another pavilion, but I don't know. I think I don't know if I'd do that on my own on the kind of place on that scale. Yeah, that was
too stressful. Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie.
Stressful. Yeah. We talked to we had Paul Priestman on the podcast the other day from Priestman Good, and one of the things he was talking about, in terms of the difference between design and architecture, was to do with producing multiples of things. I don't know if it was seats for an aeroplane company or carriages for a train. They're not just producing a one-off thing, they're producing multiples of them. But a lot of your furniture is fairly bespoke, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I guess, it'd just be interesting about whether your plans are for, it would be relatively easy, I guess, for you to go into bulk producing.
Yeah, I mean that was the plan when I first started designing furniture, and the aim was to, you know, to hopefully work with a really big brand, and you know, maybe sort of have my chairs or tables like mass produced, so it's, you know, available for everyone. But what happened was that when I started designing furniture and I started to exhibit it in public spaces, people were really afraid to sort of sit on the furniture, and you know. They always felt that the chairs that I was designing was very much, it was sculptural. And then galleries and, you know, like curators always got in touch with me and wanted to sort of show the work in ways that I never really felt, you know, I never really saw my work could be displayed or showcased in. So I think me designing furniture that's very sculptural and one-off pieces, I think kind of happened... by accident, and that was purely based on like how people interacted with the work and how they, you know, saw the work and how what the work meant to them. But I still, you know, I'm aiming hopefully maybe next year to produce a range of furniture that will be mass produced or produce a limited edition range of furniture. Yeah, that will be launched online or through a furniture manufacturer. But yeah. That was something that kind of happened by accident. It was always my plan to, you know, to produce furniture on the large scale.
So were you surprised when people saw them as kind of art pieces?
I was I think when I was designing the chairs, each chair had its own kind of narrative, and it was based on a personal life experience or based on an individual that I grew up with in school or someone that I, you know, someone that I respected. I wanted to sort of retell their narrative in the chair. So, I was surprised. Yeah, because I would always try and encourage people to, you know, to sit on my chairs and use the chairs in exhibitions, but they refused to because they just always said, it's too precious. It's glossy. Will it break and all this stuff. And I'm like, no, like please, like have a seat. But they just wouldn't. And that's when I changed, the kind of work that I was doing and made and started to create work that was more sculptural and less functional. And that's when, museums and galleries and wanted to kind of exhibit the work and show the work in a different way. So yeah, I was surprised, because that was never my plan, no.
And then I guess that contrasts quite With the kind of conversations around the Thessaly Road competition, which were all about robustness and what happens if people scratch it, kick it, touch it, and all the horrible things that happen to stuff in the public realm. Yeah. It's kind of interesting working in very opposite contexts.
Yeah, it was, because I think with the work that I, with the work with the chairs that I do, it's in a way... It's kind of a reflection of my culture. And I always reference that, you know, like in Nigerian culture, everyone's always sort of like dressed really well and like appearance is really, really key. So there were elements of my culture in my work, and I always try and reference bits of me or my identity in these objects. Because I know, as when I was growing up and when I was in university, I was always quite shy. I'm still a bit shy now, actually, to be fair, believe it or not. But I kind of, you know, like to kind of design something and then leave it for people to kind of have their own opinion on it, because people will always have an opinion on something. So if I can design something and leave it in a public space and then pretend that it's not mine and just listen to people and hear what they say about something, I always find some sort of joy in that, you know. And I think with, like, the Colour Palace and Thessaly Road, you know, I've been there, like, on numerous occasions and heard people say such nice things about both projects. And they don't know, you know, I have anything to do with it. So that's amazing. That's always nice just to see and hear, you know.
And then you talked a little bit there just about the kind of Nigerian influence. You talked about growing up in North London, in school in North London. Yep. You were born in London. Yep. The influence comes, I guess, from your parents. Who were they born in Nigeria? What's the...
Born in Nigeria, that's right, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, the kind of balancing, really, that a lot of kids try maybe and rebel against their parents or the culture of their parents.
Yeah. I mean... do you know what? My parents are really strict, you know. I tried to rebel. I thought I was rebelling, but it just didn't work, you know. it wasn't happening. I'm a failed rebel. It didn't work, you know. My parents they were strict, yeah, and I'm always really grateful for them, for being like really strict, because, for any parent, I think raising, you know, like, you know, children in London now, you know, like, isn't the most easiest of tasks, you know. But I think if you, it's not about trying to, I don't know, it's just like trying to teach your kids, you know, respect and love and, like, you know, like, empathy and I don't know, like, just talking to them at home, I think is really key. But then also, like, I think seeing my parents' journey and sort of seeing, like, they're, like, how hard they worked, you know, sort of, you know, in Nigeria and then coming over here to London and, you know, sort of starting from scratch. I think it was really inspirational. So I think for me, we never really wanted to sort of let them down and never let them sort of feel they've wasted their time on something that they, they had hope that this is how things would turn out for them. And I'm really happy that, you know, we're all kind of doing things that we love and no one's really sort of made them, I don't know, disappointed them. We all rebelled, but I don't know, it didn't really work, you know. We still had to go to uni, still had to wash dishes, had to hoover the floor. They were strict. But I'm grateful. We needed that, you know. We needed that.
And then, I mean, does travelling back or travelling to Nigeria, does that enhance your sense of feeling like a Londoner? Yeah, do you, what's the kind of flip side to...
It's weird, yeah. Because whenever I go back to Nigeria, and I, you know, I say, like, we say to my cousins or, like, friends, oh, you know, we're home and it's so nice to be back. And they're like, this is not home. You're not home. You're not Nigerian. I'm like, I am. I've got a Nigerian passport. And I've got a British one. But like, no, you can't have both. But I was like, I love both, you know, my Nigerian and also my British culture. But yeah, I always, you know, like, I think I'll always have that, you know, like, I know, like, question of like that, you know, of like that sort of sense of belonging, because you know, like, people sometimes will tell you, you know, you don't, I don't know, like, you're British, you're Nigerian. But, I don't know, I always try to embrace, you know, like, both of my cultures, because that's what I think sets me apart from a designer, an artist, an architect, or, you know, from different people, because I have, you know, what my experience and my stories will always will be different from my family to my grandmother, to just things that they tell me and things that I experience on my travels in different parts of Nigeria. So, yeah, I think it's always a blessing to kind of have, you know, like two nationalities. Yeah.
I guess my kind of, it was a final question really, was about fixing things in London and what, yeah, there's a bit of time, people are trapped inside. Is there, you know, it's kind of a question about what's next really and whether, you know, given complete free rein to do anything anywhere in London, what you'd want to change or what would be your, you know, next wish list for changing things in London once lockdown is over.
I think, yeah, if they're really doing this, yeah, I think more public room projects, commissions, yeah. That's I need more I don't know, I feel like the Colour Palace and, you know, like Test Road Bridge was such, you know, like major projects in London. I think it, you know, it brought so much joy to people's lives and it brought so much people together, cultures, communities, you know, and it's I think it's, you know, it's a legacy and I think it's something that will live on forever and I think in our memories and our minds and I think just, yeah, more projects in public spaces is what I want to do a lot more. And I feel like this is something that we're going to need, kids are going to need. I think it's also hard for young children as well, like being told they can't see their friends and can't go play in the park. So, you know, and I think they're also missing out on lots of memories and playtime and creating and also that's, again, part of the growth. So, I don't know, I think just I want to create more public run projects. And also, I would love to do a permanent public playground. That is actually a dream project. I'm going to put it out there for anyone who's listening. I want to design.
If you've got any local authorities listening, they know how to get in touch.
Yeah, because the ones I've seen, actually, I've seen lots of playgrounds, and they're not nice. They're not really.
They all look a bit. They all look a bit sad at the moment.
They look sad.
Red tape around, yeah, to keep kids off.
Yeah. So if anyone's listening, I would love to design a playground, a permanent playground, in a park somewhere in London. So, yeah, please.
Awesome. And I guess kind of a final question is just reflecting back, as you were saying, on this kind of current situation. And do you think there are kind of lessons either that you've kind of learn personally or through practice or just as a kind of wider city that we could take forward? Like, people have mentioned, you know, how nice it is to be able to run and cycle in the streets without the traffic, or how different technologies are enabling us to work internationally in different ways. I just wonder if there's any reflections that you've taken.
There has been, yeah, and I think the thing that I think from a kind of designer's perspective, and I think because we work like mad non-stop on all these projects, it's just I've learned to sort of take things slow a bit more, you know. And I think there is a lot of pressure, in every industry to, you know, to deadlines and have stuff delivered on time and just keep going all the time, and it's not healthy, you know. And I think what I've learned now is to sort of take time to breathe, and, you know, just sort of, you know, like enjoy reading a lot more and walking and like just, you know, just doing things I don't usually do and just allowing myself to kind of process my thoughts than being, I don't know, like my thoughts being kind of rushed and not really, I don't know, not processed the way that I think it should be. So I think, yeah, just kind of taking time to slow down, I think it's been really good. And I think that's something I think my team is doing a lot more and slowing down. I think also, I think everyone's kind of taking some time out and not stressing out. I don't know. So I think for me, it's just kind of slowing down a bit and just really worrying about things that are really important and things that are not important. Just having a slower life is because I don't think this kind of gap now and this kind of pace of things will never really come again. I don't think, you know, I don't know. So I'm trying to like really.
It's gonna be a lot.
It is, yeah. So I'm really embracing it. Yeah, to, you know, to slow things down and really think about a lot of things, you know, a lot of things. And I think I really, this is not to say like the stuff I've done before in the past has not been good, but I think the stuff that I'm designing now is way stronger. It's way stronger than the stuff I think I've designed years ago, yeah, like in the past.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Yinka. It's been a great run through of your work. So you've been listening to Architecture Masters at Home. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
And I'm Tansy Thompson.
Thanks for listening.